Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on WeDigPodcasts.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Ian, and with me, as always, are my comrades and co-hosts, Tracy.
Hello.
And Colina.
Hello.
Every fortnight, we discuss two bands. One smaller band, one larger band, in popularity rather than size.
Rather than size. Polyphonic spree.
I mean, obviously, some of the bands are bigger than some of the other bands.
Some bands are bigger than others.
We rarely discuss bands that are exactly equal in height and weight.
Some bands' mothers are bigger than other bands' mothers.
But I have to do the intro for this one because Colin is not allowed to pronounce the letter that we're doing.
No.
H!
Because he does that with it. The letter today is H.
H.
And we are doing Husker Du and Jimi Hendrix.
You can't have it both ways.
I can.
No, you can't.
That's the
letter H for
that's
Hendrix,
the rules.
Or it's
the
letter H for Hendrix.
Like, this is how you can pronounce historic in two different ways, depending on the word in front of it.
Yeah, I've always thought people that say historic are weird.
No, an historic is a better way to say it than an historic.
Yeah, I always say a historic.
Yeah, but that's wrong.
I don't care. I literally do not give a fuck.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Tracy, do you want to tell us about Husker Du? Okay, because you've been doing a lot of fucking research.
On a band you already know very well.
It was a good excuse to get
tell me about Incubus, Tracy. Do you know anything about Incubus?
Absolutely fuck all.
Yeah, good. Great. Well done. We'll sort that one out next episode. Talk about Husker Du.
Husker Du.
Husker Du.
I'm going to read a bit from a PR release that was done at the time they signed to Warner's for Candy Apple Grey. And it says, one of the most critically and popularly acclaimed new bands in recent memory is a trio of musicians hailing from Minneapolis, St. Paul, collectively known as Husker Du. The proper pronunciation of the band's name is Husker Du, and was originally derived from the Scandinavian board game, which translates as Do You Remember?
Which is one of their songs.
The Huskers are yet another example of an overnight sensation that in actuality was years in the making. They played their first gig in March 1979, and since then a hectic schedule has included 20 separate tours in the last 4 years. By the way, this is 1986 we're talking.
No, we're not. This is 2018. Crazy lady.
And the press release carries on with a sound that has often been described as ultracore. There's a genre name we've never had.
Ultracore?
What a fucking...
A harsh hypersonic pop. Husker Du...
Bob Mould write that?
I think he might have actually written some of this.
Ultracore?
Ultracore. They're a solid critics' favourite, with their records remaining near the top of college radio playlists for months at a time.
Oh no. Critics' favourite.
Self-produced and self-managed, Husker Du are simply unwilling to answer and be responsible to others for their creative directions.
We're Husker Du.
Maybe their records would have sounded better if they'd actually paid attention to things like producers.
Yeah. We will get into that.
So the lineup was Grant Hart on drums and vocals, Bob Mould on guitars and vocals, and Greg Norton on bass
and no vocals.
Very occasional vocals. Okay. He sang a couple and occasionally did backing vocals. There was a fourth member, Charlie Pine, on keyboards. They formed a band because Charlie speculatively got them a gig.
They were at a bar one night, and their mate Charlie came back from the bar and said, "We've got to form a band. I've just got us a gig here next week."
Wow.
So they hadn't even jammed together properly at that point, had they?
No, so they kind of just set up as a Ramones covers band, basically. But the other three started rehearsing without him and writing their own material because they were getting a bit bored of just doing the covers. And at their second performance, they were told at the end, "Oh, you can have another 15 minutes. And so they did an encore and did some of their own stuff.
With Charlie standing there going, "What the fuck is this?
What key is this in, guys?" He started trying to jam along, and one of their friends allegedly pointed at the other three members of the band and gave an enthusiastic thumbs up, pointed at Charlie and gave a thumbs down, and unplugged his keyboards. He was essentially fired on stage at their second
gig. Wow.
So they were a trio ever since.
I've seen that nearly happen, or similar to that happen, at a gig once in Tamworth years ago. Do you remember there was a Battle of the Bands years ago?
Was that the band that sounded a bit like Oasis and were going on forever?
They were a band that were absolutely terrible, overrunning their set by about 5 or 6 minutes.
Yeah.
And somebody just walked to the back
of
the stage.
Chris
Berry. Yes, that was it. Just walked to the back of the stage and unplugged the power.
He walked all the way across the stage, unplugging all of the amps, and then walked off, like, up one set of stairs, across, and then off again, and then out the front door. I know this because I had to stop the band from finding him and trying to beat him up.
So, back to Husker Du. They released 6 studio albums and 2 live albums, as well as a box set archive release of their early material and a heap more live stuff.
And the debut, interestingly, was a live record.
Yeah.
Mm. Which is quite good. MC5 did that, didn't they? Kick Out the Jams was live, and that was their first one.
Mm.
But it's I think that's a pretty cool way of doing things, because it's really cheap to do. They've obviously been practicing by playing, but it's basically they just did their fastest, punkest, hardest tracks.
Yeah,
and I think it's about 29 minutes long and about 16 tracks, something like that.
Yeah, it's 17 songs in 26 minutes.
It's not on Spotify, so I've not actually heard it, but on the box set there is a almost identical set from the same time.
Yeah, pretty much.
That I've listened to.
It was described as a fiery mix of adrenaline and bile, a 200 proof distillation of rage. and if you listen closely, you can almost hear the blood boil. But it's fairly incoherent. Will on Twitter described it as being recorded on a fucked Walkman in the next town.
Yeah.
I heard it, bizarrely.
But then so are their studio albums.
We'll come to that in a bit. I actually heard Candy Apple Grey first.
Same here.
I would have heard Makes No Sense At All, the first one around Flip Your Wig time. I'd have heard John Peel play that. Then I would have heard Candy Apple Grey. And then then I would have heard Landspeed Record, the debut live one, after that. And going from Candy Apple Grey to Landspeed Record was such a difference.
Oh, yeah.
That I didn't like Landspeed Record at all.
I never properly listened to Husker Du until we started rehearsing.
Oh, really?
I've owned Candy Apple Grey for probably about 15 years. Maybe coming up to 20 years. I'd always heard loads of bands that I love citing them as an influence.
Yeah, same.
I think it was on sale when I worked. In fact, yeah, it's got to be 17, 18 years ago, because it was on sale when I worked in a record shop.
Yeah.
and I didn't listen to it before I bought it, which was unusual when I worked in the record shop, because I just used to put stuff on in the back room if I wanted to listen to it.
Yeah.
And I took it home and I put it on and I couldn't get over the production.
Yeah, that was my problem with it.
The drums are terrible. They're played fantastically. Grant Hart is a fantastic drummer. They're brilliant songwriters. The guitar playing's great. The bass playing's fine. But the drums fine. But it's so badly recorded.
Yeah.
The drums are just... It's all treble. There's no kick to it. There's no force to it. And it doesn't sound like how it would have sounded when you were in the room with them. It's not that they've just stuck a microphone in front of it, because it would sound better.
Yeah. I mean, when I was talking about
somebody's done that deliberately.
Well, someone on Twitter actually said that the it was great songs let down by awful production, and the drums sound like they've been played on biscuit tins.
And then
someone else said that the production is truly shocking. It's not shambolic. It's embarrassingly incompetent for a major label record. It sounds like it was recorded in a U-bend.
I mean, Candy Apple Grey is worse. It's got a worse drum sound than the earlier records, but the earlier records are still quite badly recorded.
Like, it's worse produced than Guitar Wolf, and Guitar Wolf did record on Walkmans.
Yeah.
Right.
But that sounds great.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think we've established before that I like shambolically produced records.
But it's not that it's shambolically produced.
Yeah, it just sounds terrible. It's like listening to someone's phone recording of a band.
Yeah.
But thinner.
But like,
it's still such a great album.
It's great. But
I honestly couldn't.
The earlier stuff...
I couldn't.
I mean, Zen Arcade...
Yeah.
The drums are still quite badly recorded on that. And so I was wondering if it was the budget and that kind of thing and what they'd got to deal with at the time. But Minutemen's Double Nickels on the Dime was released and was recorded at the same time and put out on the same label. Both on SST on the same day. And the production on Double Nickels on the Dime is fucking great. Nice crisp drums. Yeah. You know, there's power to it. So it could have been done. So,
well, I mean, you're looking at fucking records like Pet Sounds were recorded on 4 tracks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, like years previously, and they sound great.
But then, so Pet Sounds isn't a good comparison, because there's not. They're not going for power.
But they are going for quality sound.
They're going for crisp sounding. But their Husker Du, stuff like Black Sabbath, Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, it's all better produced.
They're better produced, and they were 10 years earlier.
Yeah, it was ridiculous on the playlist. You're like, oh, this is fucking Tinian crap. And then you skip to Hendrix, and you're like, how is this an older record sounding so much crisper, clearer, and more well-recorded? How?
I just wish... And it's not the way it's mixed, so it's not like somebody could go back to the master tapes... I mean, redo it.
They never spent a lot of time on their recording.
Yeah.
They would spend a couple of days.
But
it's
to their absolute detriment.
Yeah, like, I couldn't...
But I don't think...
Because the songs are fucking great.
Yeah, because I know, I'm familiar with Diane because of the Therapy cover version, and I listened to the Husker Du version, and I was like, oh my God, how has anyone decided to cover it from this? And I couldn't... I really wanted to get into it, because I know Bob Mould is a great songwriter, and I'd really enjoy it.
Well, that's Grant Hart, I think.
But no, because I remember at the time Bob Mould was really fucking pissy about them covering it.
No, it's a Grant Hart song.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go.
But it was still his band, so I can see why he'd be annoyed.
The thing is, I don't think the songs lose anything for their production. I don't personally.
No,
it doesn't affect me as much.
That's because you're used to listening to recordings that sound like they were made in a fucking toilet.
Yeah,
I trained myself to listen to it over the last 5-6 weeks. I've been listening to it constantly, and now my ears can cope with it better because my ears sort of fill in what the drums should sound like. And that way, yes, it is better, and I do enjoy it. Zen Arcade, I've listened to loads. It's
really
fucking fantastic record.
See, I don't get on with concept albums. Concept double albums.
It is long.
It's a rock opera. I mean, Bob Mould described it at the time as Quadrophenia, but crazier. And the thing is, it's set out to be a single album. It wasn't meant to be a double.
But they just kept going, didn't they?
Well, they just kept going. There was friction over who would get more songs. And their sound guy at the time said, Terry Katzman, he said that Mould and Hart would just fight and then go out to the van and like work out work out the songs. And he actually said they'll slam together, crash apart, and then they'd have written three more songs in that time. And the studio sessions kept going, and it was like nothing you'd ever seen.
But the problem with them writing three songs is that's an odd number, so clearly one of them's got two songs and the other one's only got one. So they need to go out and write more. So
but each of them, refused to drop any of their own songs from it, so it ended up as a double.
They were both very stubborn, weren't
and
they?
I'd have preferred a shorter album.
It sounds like most people would have preferred a single album.
To be fair, part of the length is that last track, which is a bit of a
recurring dream.
Recurring dream, which is
14 minutes long,
instrumental noodly jam.
Wig
kind
out,
of thing, which I can see you not liking.
It's kind of their interstellar overdrive, isn't it?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
It's all right. It's a bit of a Dallas ending to the album, really, isn't it? It was all a dream. Bobby Ewing, or rather Bobby Mould, wakes up in the shower.
Is that Tuth Fairy and the Princess, where it's the "It Was All a Dream" song? Just a couple of tracks before the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, my highlights on Zen Arcade are Never Talking to You Again, which is the folkier one.
Yeah.
And Pink Turns to Blue, which is just so super melodic.
Pink Turns to Blue is
probably... It's just got them high, wiry guitars that I love.
It's up there with, I would say, it's my top two songs. I can't decide the order of them between that and Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely.
Yeah. Which is just pure pop.
Yeah. But what I found was quite interesting is on the playlist that we did, all of my favourite songs on the playlist were Grant Hart songs.
Mm. Really?
So I went to investigate further of what they did after Skidoo Split.
Mm.
And I didn't like any of Grant Hart's solo albums.
Mm.
Well, they were all right. They just weren't amazing.
The Good News for Modern Man is really good. The only other one of his I've got is The Argument, and that is noodling nonsense.
Nova Mob, which was his band that he formed in the early 90s, I've got... my note here says, Nova Mob, a bit shit.
I never really listened to Nova Mob.
But Bob Mould solo stuff.
Oh, God, Bob Mould solo stuff.
And actually...
Is it better recorded?
Yes.
Maybe I might listen to it.
More to the point, Sugar,
they're amazing.
Beaster in particular, which was the leftovers from
Copper Blue.
Copper Blue, that's it. He likes albums named after colours, doesn't he? Yeah, Candy Apple Grey, Copper Blue.
Hmm.
Black Sheets of Grey.
Which I think part of why I bought Candy Apple Grey, I think I was confusing it with Copper Blue.
Right. Okay.
And then I bought it, and it wasn't quite what I was expecting.
I would have heard Candy Apple Grey back in not too long after it came out. I'd have heard it first in about 87, 88 when I first started college. And then Copper Blue, I got that probably the day it came out.
Well, who's could do have been called the first college rock band?
Yeah. I would actually go to far. I love Husker Du, I really do, but I think I prefer Sugar and Bob Mould solo to Husker Du.
Sugar, particularly Beaster, it's...
The two albums are amazing. Beaster, actually, I'm not so taken with it.
Oh, I really like Beaster. Come Around, the opening track's fucking great.
It just sounds like a terrible fucking Easter-themed horror film.
Beaster.
There was an article that Stereo Gum did about Bob Mould and Sugar and Husker Du output. They did.
Was that the way they ranked every
ranked
single one
from
of
worst
his songs?
To best,
albums. Yeah.
Beaster came somewhere in the middle, and they called it a reservoir of Mould pain and suffering that simply didn't fit on the pitch perfect sprightly pop album Copper Blue.
Yeah.
So, I've got all bar three of Bob Mould's solo albums, and I really should go back and fill those gaps.
Have you got any of his Loud Bomb records?
I've listened to it.
And me, it wasn't
very
good.
Long Playing Grooves. It's
That was his sort of electronica project. Well, he's done some electronic stuff.
Well, he did that one. He did that one the same year as he put Modulate out, and I think he put it out under the name Loud Bomb because someone actually said that Modulate should never have gone out under Bob Mould's name. It just wasn't him.
And Loud Bomb obviously is an anagram of Bob Mould. Very, very dated.
It's adequate dance music. But Modulate and the album that came after it, Body of Song, I mean, I adored them. And he got derided for trying something different, for doing something that wasn't power pop and that wasn't Husker Du. But I think when he was playing around with the auto-tune and the vocoder on those, and I think it really suited the cadence and the lilt of his voice. The way his voice like would fall and rise naturally really suited auto-tune.
I really like Beauty and Ruin. What made me listen to that one in particular was he did a Tiny Desk concert on YouTube, and the opening track on that is The War, which is really, really good. And it was just him with a, you could tell, quite loud electric guitar.
Yeah.
But not so loud that he couldn't be, he was singing with a microphone quite far off. And he was still able to hear his vocals, and it sounded great.
I mean, the album after that, his last solo one, Patch the Sky from 2016, it's classic power pop.
I think 2016 is when that concert was from, so the other songs are probably from some of the other songs.
I mean, bizarrely, 2016 and the Patch the Sky tour is the very first time I saw him live. I've always seemed to miss him when he comes around.
Isn't he almost Dinosaur Jr. levels of loud as well?
Yeah, very loud. And in fact, he still plays like Husker Du used to, in that the start of the gig, he'll count the first song in, and then he plays an hour's worth of material with pretty much no gap. It's just relentless. You can't pause for breath for the whole of it. It's brilliant. I mean, seeing him live was amazing because he did like a smattering of Husker Du, of Sugar, and his own solo material.
Which is cool because I got the impression, until I looked into it a little bit more, that when Husker Du split up, he'd been very strongly saying that they would never ever reform. And he did appear on stage once or twice with Grant Hart.
Yeah.
Obviously, unfortunately, Grant Hart died a couple of years ago now.
It was only last year.
Was it last year?
I thought we're coming up to the 1 year anniversary next month.
Yeah. So, obviously, unfortunately, can't happen now.
I mean, when they did the when they did the Savage Young Du box set and all the doing archive stuff for that, I really got my hopes up that there was going to be a reunion and. So.
He sounded very ill on that. There was a podcast called Do You Remember, which is like a history of Husker Du, which is really good, worth listening to.
It was really good.
More interested, which has got interviews with all three of them. Cool. And sort of other people around at the time. Rollins is in a fair bit.
Yeah,
he is.
Grant Hart sounds ill.
Yeah.
His voice is cracked.
It was nice to hear him, though.
Yeah. I'd never heard him talk before, so I don't know if his voice used to sound like that. But knowing already that he died of cancer not long after that would have been recorded.
I mean, what's ironic is that around the time they split, one of the tensions in the band was that he started taking heroin.
It's never a good idea. Don't do it.
Well, he basically started doing it
Tracy said, don't do it. Stop it.
He was just like, oh, well, fuck it, because he'd had a false positive on an HIV test.
Right.
And was like, well, what's the point? And so started taking heroin.
And this was late 80s, so going to be the sort of height of that kind of fear.
And it turns out that he was negative anyway. He did clean up later, but...
It's never a good plan.
No.
Main thing I knew about Husker Du, other than the album that I'd got that I couldn't get into because of the production... also, I don't know if you recognised it because it was mentioned on Twitter yesterday and you started making up your own lyrics. Irk the Purists by Half Man Half Biscuit, which has the lyrics Husker Du Du Du, Captain Beefheart E Yellow, Christa Berg Sun Ra, Delamitri John Coltrane.
Okay.
Except I rewrote my own version of it.
Yeah.
And mine were better.
So you're saying you're better than Half Man, Half Biscuit?
I got No Means No in there to rhyme with ELO, and I thought that was quite good.
Fair enough. have you ever heard the most unlikely Husker Du cover ever?
I don't know.
Robert Palmer used to cover New Day Rising.
Yeah, I read that.
Wow.
I've heard it.
Have you?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. I think they're just sort of jamming the end of another song.
Because he did it as an encore. He used to do it as an encore, apparently.
So I think it's at the end of one of his songs, because it fades in, and then he just starts singing the New Day Rising chorus over it, and then goes into something else. But it was not who you'd expect.
No, not really. But then again, there is that end of a Madonna song where she plays a Pantera riff.
Really?
Yeah.
I've not heard
a new level. Monty Pittman, her guitarist, is a very, very good metal guitarist.
Excellent.
I saw him first with Prong.
Ah.
So, you know, in the Green Day episode, you were going on about that mud fight, and there was mud all over the stage.
Yeah.
It reminded me of something I read.
Blue paint.
Yeah. So the first time that Husker Du played Chicago, they found out that Black Flag were playing in town on the same night. So they kind of billed their gig as the Black Flag after show. And someone found a tin of blue paint on stage, so started throwing it around the stage and scooping it up with a cymbal,
It got kicked over on the stage.
Yeah.
And it was the woman that ran the venue, I think.
Yeah.
Came over and tried. She was trying to scoop it up with a cymbal to get it off the stage.
Yeah.
But she pushed her over.
Yeah. In the chaos.
Right.
Black Flag at this point had just arrived at the venue. This was the first time that they'd seen Husker Du.
Yeah.
And were sort of watching it from the doorway. This woman ended up getting bounced around the stage.
Her off the wall.
She'd fallen in the paint.
Yeah.
So it ended up with arse prints on the wall of the venue where she bounced against the wall.
Wow.
Rollins tells the story very, 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 very well. And he often does.
But he was really impressed from the off. I mean, he said the energy they had, it was something he hadn't witnessed before. And he was on about, like, the way you've got Grant Hart was, like, basically holding it down with the rhythm, but Bob Mould was basically just trying to pull it all apart. And
it was the tension between the two, which is sort of how Sabbath works.
Mm.
Because you've got the drums and the bass pulling against each other, one slowing it down while the other speeds it up.
Yeah.
And that's where the groove comes from. Which, I mean, Husker Du don't have a similar sort of groove, but I can see what it'd bring excitement to the live shows at the very least.
I mean, so after Candy Apple Grey,
That we are, in fact, 2/5 of the way through Tracy's notes.
Yes. Tracy's got 5 fucking pages. We're not going to get through all of those, Tracy.
We're not. But, We've jumped around the timeline a bit, which is why I'm trying to juggle them. But so their last album before they split was another double, and it's another one where they wouldn't compromise on who. I mean, Grant Hart by this time was getting really pissed off because Bob had said, you're never going to have more than 50% of the songs on an album.
Which doesn't seem fair.
Well, that was it. I mean, this was the tension that eventually he couldn't handle Bob Mould trying to control so tightly something that was meant to be a band of equals. So
have a third of the songs there.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Hart had said in that Do You Remember
that he wanted it to be
podcast.
More equal in his direction.
Some animals are more equal than others.
Yeah.
That they ended up with so many songs, and he said the thing is they didn't really have a cutting room floor. Or if they did, that everything that fell on the floor always got swept up and put back in its proper place. And I'm thinking, no, that's not its proper place. Actually, I still would have preferred less, even on that Warehouse Songs and Stories.
Really like Warehouse.
I think it could have done with a couple.
It reminded me, because at that point, obviously, they were going a bit away from the hardcore kind of sound to the more jangly indie rock. And it really reminds me of early R.E.M.
You think?
I think R.E.M. were probably influenced by Husker Du.
I don't doubt it.
Is there somewhere, like, an album of Like a tribute album would be adequate. Just an album of Husker Du songs that are recorded well. Because I really want to get into them, and I just don't
can't get past.
Yeah,
production.
I just can't. Some bands work with that. These do not, I don't think.
There may well be a tribute album. It might be that they split up too close to the 80s, too close to the 90s to be caught up in the
90s tribute 90s album.
90s tribute album boom.
Yeah.
So they might have been too current a memory.
Oh, well.
That kind of thing.
But you never know.
But if there is one out there, yeah, let us know.
I don't know if it exists. But, no, so yeah, the cracks began to appear in the band on the tour of Warehouse. I mean, at this point, Mould had actually sobered up and stopped taking speed, but that's when Hart started taking heroin. So,
well, at least there weren't one of them taking speed and the other taking heroin, because that means you're completely pulling in the wrong directions.
Yes,
oh, God,
which is that's pretty much what split up Hawkwind. Lemmy was off his face on speed when the rest of the band were on downers.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, we can't cope with this, let me fuck off.
Yeah, please slow down. Please,
no!
Please slow down.
Do you know, Bob Mould made a really interesting point on that Do You Remember podcast about how they got gigs and information back then, you know, because there was no internet, no mobile phones, and they said they'd arrive at a new place and just drive down the high street looking for flyers in shop windows, okay, to kind of find out where the punk was. And then on the road, they were using real maps, and they had a CB radio to warn them of the speed traps, and they would be listening to some crazy Mexican radio station.
Awesome.
And he said, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that nobody gets exposed to anymore because of social media now, and everyone's got such highly self-curated lives.
Well, he,
and I thought that was a really interesting.
They were really early adopters of the internet as well.
Yeah, yeah, they were.
Bob Mould was like running news groups and stuff in the early 90s. And
yeah.
I think they first started using email in like late 80s or something when Husker Du was still going.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was still using a Spectrum at that point. I was playing Defender.
But, you know, in one of our previous episodes, I decided there should be a new feature, the Fast Show's Jesse's Diet.
Are you really trying to make it happen?
Yeah, I'm really trying to make it happen. And Greg Norton was on about...
I just really want to see your search history.
And Greg Norton was on about touring and sleeping on people's floors and eating crap while on the road. And so yeah, that leads me to the next instalment of We Dig Music's Jesse's Diets, in which this week Greg Norton has mostly been eating chili cheese fries.
Interesting.
You know what? That sounds a lot more appetising than tuna and jello or whatever it was that Jay Maskis was eating.
It does. It does.
Oh, chili cheese. Oh, I want chili cheese fries.
We get into the Rollins episode. He was eating protein.
Yeah.
Lots of protein.
But earlier than that, lots of Baskin and Robbins ice cream.
Yes.
I found a really interesting
tangent.
Was it
Baskin Robbins?
I think so. No, Haagen-Dazs.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
There's an interesting tangent I found, actually. A gig in 83, and Norton said they were playing with this shitty punk band called The Young and the Useless, which turned out to be an early incarnation of the Beastie Boys.
Oh.
I've just thought of another parallel with Green Day.
Oh, go on.
So, Greg Norton, since Husker Du split up, he's a chef, he runs a restaurant.
Yes.
Mike Dirnt's got a restaurant.
Has he?
Yeah.
What's his called?
I can't remember the name. Rudy's. Yeah, and
of
it
course.
Was named after a Clash song. Rudy's, which is in Oakland.
Oh.
But obviously, big influence because of them being a power trio.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of band. There was one thing I wanted to pick up. Tracy was on Twitter putting a thing on the Everything Indie Over 40 account, which I am illegally subscribed to. I'm only 36. so yeah, they're probably
no one could tell.
Probably going to block me now. They do like a listening party thing, where they get all the listeners to listen to an album at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of tweet about it.
Yeah, it's Rob Morgan's project.
See, I don't take part in this because I am over 40, but I am not indie.
So, so they did Candy Apple
Cray. It doesn't appeal to me.
Oh, well, their tag has always been, if it's indie to you, it's indie to us. And a lot of the stuff you like is probably come up.
Fuck off.
Okay, fair enough.
Like what? Like what?
Cult of Luna indie.
I don't know, like Mogwai or something.
Maybe I'd listen to Mogwai. Yeah.
Anyway, there was one bit I was reading through the.
Having a salt now.
I was reading through the tweets from when they did Candy Apple Grey.
Yeah.
And there was one that I just read it and I had to reread it because there was a bit about where they were listening to Sorry Somehow.
Yeah.
And the tweet said something about critics at the time weren't happy with the deep purple organ on the track. And I was just sitting there, I had to read that twice because I hadn't thought about Deep Purple, the band. And I was just thinking, if you've got a deep purple organ, you probably need to loosen your grip a little bit there.
Just a touch.
Oh, shit, we're packing Green Bay songs, aren't we?
it literally took me 30 seconds to realise that it wasn't referring to a penis.
About your life as it
probably.
Yeah,
I am a Green Day fan.
Yeah, Rob, if you're listening, I'm sorry for my friend.
Oh, I love it when you have to apologise for it. It's brilliant. Have you got much more from your fucking six more pages?
No, no. Although, actually, one of our previous episodes, when we did the Christmas special last year, and we mentioned one of my then new favourite bands, The Telepaths, who I saw live last night and met the band. They listened to that episode. And he actually enjoyed...
Sorry.
He said he actually...
Not sorry.
Tom said he enjoyed you two ripping them apart, actually. So there
the
you
sound
go.
Sound of Kettering.
Did he say that while crying a little bit? Did he look really sad when he was saying it? Like, you know, yeah no, that was fine.
Didn't they also say that the song that you had chosen was their least favourite of their own
they
songs?
They did.
You badly represented them. I bet they're really good.
I say, The Telepaths, when you listen to this, right, could you just tweet us a list of songs that you think we'd enjoy?
Yeah, and we'll give them a list.
I mean, they don't even have to be your songs, just a list of songs we think we'd enjoy.
Shall we talk about Jimi Hendrix now?
Yeah.
Yes, let's.
Let me stand next to that particular fire.
Marshall Hendrix, better known as Jimmy, is an American rock/blues guitarist.
Was.
And singer. Was, yeah, unfortunately. People know who Hendrix is. I don't really need to introduce him, do I?
Not so much.
I really fucking like Hendrix. But yeah, he came to prominence in 1967 when he was first discovered playing at a small club in New York by Keith Richards' girlfriend, Linda Keith.
Wow.
Which is a bit weird that his girlfriend's name had got his name as her.
Imagine if they'd got married and double-barreled.
Yeah.
Keith Richards. Linda Keith Richards.
Linda Keith Richards Keith. But
Linda Richards Keith.
She discovered him playing at a gig. He was in Curtis Knight's backing band.
Oh.
And she was absolutely blown away by his playing. Got to know him, lent him, because he was playing a really shitty guitar at the time, lent him one of Keith Richards' white Stratocasters.
Did Keith know?
He wasn't very happy. She later on then went to see him play at a show where he smashed up a guitar on stage. It wasn't the same one, but she was then thinking, fucking hell, I've lent her one of Keith's.
Oh.
So, yeah, I think there were a few arguments about that. But she decided she was going to try and get him signed and brought over to London, because he was playing to completely indifferent people in New York.
Yeah.
He was just, mostly at the time, he was playing backing in various different bands. He played with the Isley Brothers.
Yeah.
He played Little Richard, he was in the backing band for.
Wow.
For a little bit. But America, despite it coming from there, America wasn't as interested in blues at the time. Whereas England were absolutely, in the mid to late 60s, they were absolutely obsessed with blues. So you'd got people like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, who would play to an empty room in America, doing sell-out tours of the UK. So she knew that she wanted to get him over to England.
Yeah.
So she invited loads of different record company bosses, like Andrew Lou Goldham, obviously the Rolling Stones manager, who didn't see the interest in him at all. I think Hendrix was a bit patchy with his gigs at that point.
Ah.
And some of them he wasn't really putting the work in. And so all of these guys turned it down, and then Linda one day was talking to Chas Chandler, who was the bass player from the Animals, who was talking about he was going to leave the Animals and he wanted to go into managing.
Okay.
And Chas was absolutely obsessed with Hey Joe. It hadn't been a hit. Loads of people had covered it, but he knew that if the right person covered it, he could make it a hit in the UK.
Yeah.
So she dragged him down to see Hendrix play at Café Wah. Don't look for it, it's not there anymore.
Okay.
Coincidentally, part of his set, he was playing his version of Hey Joe.
Oh.
And Chas Chandler was absolutely blown away by it. And then Hendrix was started playing with his teeth and playing his guitar behind his head, which nobody did that kind of thing at that point.
Yeah.
And he was just like, we've got to get you to London. So paid for a plane ticket.
Wow.
So they had to get him a passport, which, because he'd never been outside of the States. Even when he was in the army. He was forced into the army.
Conscripted?
Got caught in a stolen car.
Right.
And
The standard go to prison or go to the army.
Or go to the army. So he chose the army, became a 101st Regiment paratrooper.
Yeah.
The Screaming Eagles.
Yes. And narrowly missed being sent to Vietnam. And there's sort of conflicting stories about why he was discharged from the army. There's some that he was just that useless a soldier. Apparently he's on record, they've got his reports from being in the army, which was, he never turned up to like inspections and stuff like that, and couldn't give a shit, which, fair play. But then there's also reports that he was actually discharged in the end because he landed badly from a parachute jump and broke his ankle. But either way, he managed to get out of the army just before he would have had to go to Vietnam, where loads of his friends end up getting killed. He met a guy called Billy Cox while he was in the army, who later became a bass player with him in Band of Gypsies later on. He came over to London.
He lived with Chas Chandler, didn't he?
I think the first night Chas Chandler put him up in his house, but then they arranged, they got a flat for him in Mayfair, I think it is. Which used to be the flat where Handel, the composer, lived.
Oh, wow.
Oh, cool.
So it's now a museum to both of them.
Has it got a blue plaque?
It's got a blue plaque. It took years to persuade English Heritage to put up a plaque for Hendrix. They'd already got the Handel one there.
I know, because they're terrible about that.
Really, really snobby. Cathy Etchingham, which was Hendrix's long-term girlfriend, who he lived with in that flat, she basically campaigned for it and finally got it sorted in mid to late 90s. They put the plaque up, and then a couple of years ago they opened it as a museum kind of thing.
Whereas Ian's mum campaigned to get a blue plaque put up to the person who started Reliant Cars.
Yeah.
In Tamworth.
Fair enough.
It's because there's not that much going on in Tamworth.
No.
There's not got to work with what you've got.
It's still pretty cool.
We need blue plaques in Tamworth for Julian Cope and Wolfsbane, though. Somewhere.
Well, I actually asked her about that.
Yeah, but, no, I think the Julian Cope one's in, but it's a different council because it's Mileoak, which is Lichfield.
Right. Yeah.
And also Molesworth one as well.
I'd have said the Mill Lane one would have been.
I'd have thought the Mill Lane one would have been more
iconic
appropriate.
Iconic house for...
Definitely. Kobe. I don't think Julian Cope would be into it, though.
No, he wouldn't. He's never come back to Tamworth to play a gig. And stuff like that sort of thing.
And anyway, don't they have to be dead to...
Perhaps let's not kill Julian Cope
so we
can get him a blue plaque or
anyway, sorry, back to Jimi Hendrix.
So one of the things that Chas Chandler said to encourage Hendrix to come over was he was a really big fan of Cream, and particularly Eric Clapton.
Double whipped.
Fresh. Their first album was Fresh Cream, which was the only album out by that point. He was a big Clapton fan, so at this point, Eric Clapton was the guitarist.
Yeah.
There was graffiti all over London saying Clapton is God.
Yeah.
And at that point, he was the guitar hero, basically, that every young guitarist aspired to be. People hadn't discovered that Clapton was a complete racist cunt at that point yet, so... You know,
it was only discovered when he actually said it live on stage.
In Birmingham in the 70s, absolutely. Yep. Chas said, look, I can get you to meet Clapton and, you know, hang out with him a bit. So he was very much up for that, got on the plane. And Cream, just a couple of nights after Hendrix arrived in London, so the first time they met, he was playing at Regent Street Polytechnic. And they'd arranged beforehand that Hendrix was going to come on stage. They'd never heard him play before.
Yeah.
Chas had told him that he was good, you know, he was competent enough to join one of the biggest blues bands in the country on stage.
Yeah.
So Hendrix got on stage, suggested that they play the cover of Howlin' Wolf's Killing Floor, which they didn't really know. Apparently Clapton hadn't quite mastered it yet, was the wording that I'd been told. And Hendrix...
He'd been playing that one in his live set.
Well, Hendrix's thoughts were, if you're in a blues band, you should fucking know Killing Floor.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, an absolute classic blues song. Hendrix used to play it live loads. So Hendrix started playing, sort of taught him a couple of the chords on stage, and then they just started playing. And Clapton was absolutely astounded by how good Hendrix was.
Yeah.
To the point that he stopped playing, put his guitar down and stormed backstage.
Shortly afterwards became a massive racist.
I'm wondering if it maybe contributes.
Unconnected.
But, so Chas Chandler went backstage to see what was happening, and Clapton was there really angrily smoking and, like, shaking in anger, and he was like, you never told me it was that fucking good. which is great, because fuck you, Clapton.
Absolutely. Well, that's,
there were, in fact, tears in heaven.
That cover, Killing Floor, Jimmy actually wanted to put that... He wanted to record a cover of that for the B-side of Hey Joe.
Okay.
But Chas Chandler was of the opinion that if you're going to get on, you've got to have some of your own material.
Yeah.
And so told,
so they were both covers.
So told Jimmy to write a song of his own, and so he kind of wrote it to order. But so he put Stone Free,
right?
And
which is a great song.
Yeah.
Killing Floor, I've got on a BBC Sessions compilation. But Ian's just trying to rescue one of Rasputin's toys out from underneath Tracy's microphone stand.
I apologise.
Hear some banging. Firstly, it was the cat, then it was Ian kicking it by accident.
Yes, the flurry of small bangs was Rasputin flailing his little paws around.
And also, apologies if we seem distracted because I've just been watching Rasputin playing. Sorry.
But yeah, Cream was sort of the closest similar band to the Jimi Hendrix experience at the time. So I decided to listen to their first album yesterday.
Cream?
Fresh Cream.
Yeah. It's a good album.
It's a good album, but it's so much safer and more polite. And I can see why people were blown away. It's by Hendrix.
Yeah.
Because it's so much more restrained.
Mm.
Cream's later stuff was a lot fuzzier and noisier.
Yeah, because they
heard Hendrix and they realised that they could do that.
Mm.
So he came over basically and showed everyone how it could be done.
Exactly. He used to get called by the press as the wild man of rock and roll, which was probably 90% racism.
Yeah.
Because they used to say that he looked like the wild man of Borneo.
Mm.
And that was just because they hadn't seen many black people. But I think part of it, compared to the restrained way that all the white guys and the main British bands were playing,
yeah,
there was probably some legitimacy in why they described him as that. And I don't think that was entirely due to it being the 60s and most people being racist pricks.
To try and put a non-racist slant on why he was called the Wild Thing, he appeared at the 1967 Monterey Festival and he followed The Who.
They tossed a coin,
to decide.
Neither wanted to follow the other.
Exactly. And so The Who went on first, but Hendrix, sort of knowing that he had to top their finale, their guitar-destroying finale, he did something that it was actually a stunt he'd done before. He set fire to his guitar with the lighter fuel.
That was the last time he did it. He only ever did it three or four times.
Yeah, well, he'd done it before at Chandler's request as a PR stunt, because he'd been out on a tour with the Walker Brothers and Engelbert Humperdinck.
It was Cat Stevens as well.
Oh, was it?
A really mismatched tour.
A really mismatched.
I still love the fact that Engelbert Humperdinck is a stage name.
Yeah.
But, yes.
His real name is Benedict Cumberbatch.
But the thing is, so this is another one of the reasons he got called the Wild Man. But Jimmy actually later regretted this, that people started coming for the Wild Man routine rather than the music.
This is it. He wanted to be seen for the music rather than all the sort of
the stunts.
Yes, and he dressed in a manner that suggested that.
Well,
he dressed in a manner that he liked. He liked brightly coloured clothes. He liked the company of many women.
Yes.
He was fucking enjoying himself, to be fair to the guy.
Yeah.
You know, he'd come from... grew up in basically poverty.
Mm.
Yeah.
And suddenly he was the highest paid musician in the world. That was for his live shows. Admittedly, I think if the Beatles were still playing live at that point, they'd probably have been getting paid more. But at that point, towards the last couple of years, I mean, the time period that his career spanned is four. So if you count the start of his proper career as being from when he came to London until he died,
yeah,
it was about three or four days short of exactly 4 years.
That's a very short career.
Really short period of time. And for the amount of music that he... I mean, he's...
And for the amount of influence.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, a lot of the things that he did, other people were doing, or had done before, but not done in quite the way that he was.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've spoken to guitarists before who have been like, Hendrix wasn't that good. There's, you know, other people that have done way more harder things. But that was since, yeah. At the time, he laid the fucking groundwork for every guitarist that's come afterwards. Yeah. I mean, we talked at length in the O episode last year about Black Sabbath inventing heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
But that was massively, massively influenced by Hendrix. For the fuzz tone. If you listen to there's a track called Manic Depression on the first Jimi Hendrix album. We've not mentioned the other members of the Experience yet, which was Noel Redding on bass and Mitch Mitchell on drums. Mitch Mitchell's drumming, he was a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
And the swing and the groove in his playing was so influential on Bill Ward.
Yeah.
So the groove that they'd got on Manic Depression and other similar songs like that absolutely must have been a direct influence on Sabbath's basically mutant blues.
Yeah.
It's weird because you know that I don't like traditional guitar solo as much.
Yeah,
and, really?
And no, really.
We have never discussed this.
You don't like people with technique.
and I'll accuse artists of wigging too much. But Jimi Hendrix doesn't... Well, he wigs. But
a lot.
He does.
But
he does.
But it doesn't always annoy me because, I mean, the bass line carries such a groove.
How did you get on with tracks like Machine Gun and the Voodoo Child Blues in the playlist that I put on there?
That version of Voodoo Child, actually, I skipped. Sorry.
Oh, I love that. So Voodoo Child, on Electric Ladyland, there's two different versions.
Yeah.
There's Voodoo Child.
Mm-hmm. Which I love.
No, you're talking about Voodoo Child Slight Return.
Okay, sorry.
Which is the one that everyone knows.
Right, yes. Okay, yeah, sorry.
Voodoo Child is a 15 and a half minute long blues jam. And it's fucking brilliant. I love it. There's a couple of bits on it. They're recording it in front of a small audience.
Yeah.
I don't think it was actually on stage that they recorded it. I think they just got that many hangers-on in the studio with them. Charles Chandler used to come in and have to get three half-naked girls out of his chair in the studio, which actually led to him quitting.
He got sick of the entourage.
Yeah, Chaz gave Hendrix an ultimatum. He was like, either your entourage of these 15 women that you're having in bed with you every night have to go, or I do. And Hendrix, he thought about it for a very long time, I think.
A tenth of a second.
And went, that short, dumpy bloke from Newcastle probably isn't as essential as these 15 naked ladies are. fair play.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a couple of bits where they're jamming on Voodoo Child, and then they sort of bring it down, and everybody claps, and it's one of my favourite recorded moments ever. I love how that sounds. It's like up there with the bit on Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison Blues, live at Folsom Prison.
Yeah.
No, it's live at San Quentin, I think. It's one of those. I've got both of them on the same set. But it's where he says, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. And all of the convicts cheer, which is fucking brilliant. But yeah, that and Machine Gun are quite sort of lengthy jams. What about Machine Gun then? Did you skip that or
possibly?
Tracy, you've done loads of research for this one. Tracy spent the last 2 weeks just concentrating on Bob Mould entirely.
Yep.
The next few episodes will show that.
Yes. I think it's fairly clear that I'm a big Hendrix fan.
Yeah.
If my daughter had have been a boy, she was going to be called Jimmy. When I told my dad that, he told me that I was very nearly called Hendrix.
Wow.
And then he thought against it, which is a very, very, very valid reason. He wanted me to learn to play the guitar when I was older.
Yeah.
And the amount of fucking pressure you would have if you were a guitarist and you were called Hendrix.
Yeah.
Also, you'd have been named after a pencil.
Is there a pencil called Hendrix?
HB.
Yeah, fair enough.
Initials are important too.
Yeah, this is true. It's not as bad as some initials.
No.
No. Didn't spell like Bellend or something like that.
No.
But yeah, Hendrix, I grew up loving. He's one of my dad's favourites. My dad's two favourite artists is Jimi Hendrix and The Who.
Yeah.
This
is why he looks so judgily at me whenever we play in My Generation and I fuck it up. Yeah.
So one of my earliest memories is a weird parallel to Tracy's horrifying memory of being forced to listen to Queen on headphones.
Yeah.
I can remember when I was really little, my dad putting some headphones on and playing Crosstown Traffic with the guitars going from one speaker to the other and sort of panning left and right. And I was hooked from there. One of my first ever music cassettes, after Theseus and the Minotaur and my other story tapes, was I had Hendrix on one side and REM on the other.
Yeah.
There's a 90s indie band called Shudder to Think who do a cover of Crosstown Traffic, and they make it sound like one of their songs. It doesn't sound like Crosstown Traffic anymore, and I absolutely love it.
I've only ever heard a couple of their tracks. They're on the Velvet Goldmine soundtrack.
Right.
There's a track called Hot Ones on there, which sounds exactly like a lost 70s glam rock.
Oh, okay.
Classic, which is what they're supposed to be trying
to
do.
Yeah, yeah. I know there's really this female-fronted 90s band that did a cover version of Fire as well.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
What were they called?
They were called Crucial Taunt.
Crucial Taunt! Ah, yes, I've seen a documentary about them.
Exactly.
I believe that they were sort of...
linked in with a cable access TV show,
TV in Aurora, Illinois, yes.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, I'm familiar with their work.
I love that version of Fire. I'm going to lie. It's really
Fire
good.
Is great. It's one of the few songs where Noel Redding sort of takes the lead.
Yeah.
Because the bass line on it is what drives the whole thing.
Mm.
Noel Redding, I've met him once.
Yeah.
He's a fucking grumpy bastard. He's dead now. But him and Hendrix never got on very well at all. He actually, when he came to audition, was under the belief that he was turning up to audition for a rhythm guitarist in the Animals.
Right.
Got there and Chas Chandler was like, nah, actually, it's a bass player for this new guitarist from America. And he was a guitarist. He was a folk guitarist.
Right.
And he wanted more creative input. I think he was a little bit miffed by the fact that the band was the Jimi Hendrix Experience,
yeah,
and not an equal partnership. I think Mitch Mitchell was fine with it.
Yeah, I feel like if I was in a band with someone like Hendrix, I'd be like, yeah, no, that's fine.
So I met him at he was at the guitar show about 20 years ago at the NEC.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was on the, I think he was on the Marshall stand signing posters, along with Jim Marshall.
Yeah.
And then, who used to be there every year until he died. I used to get signed posters from Jim Marshall every single year. but yeah, then there was a Hendrix tribute guy that was playing who like looked and sounded, he'd got the look and the sound sorted, and Noel Redding came up to do a couple of songs with him, and I think he played Fire, but cool. He was generally he wasn't a cheerful man.
No,
but that was another one a little bit like Dinosaur Jr., where they used to, Hendrix would go to the studio at he'd tell Noel Redding a completely different time that they were getting there. Noel would go in, record his parts, Hendrix would turn up later on and record the bass parts again over.
That's a bit of a dick move, isn't it?
They hated each other.
I read a piece in Mojo by Eddie Kramer, recording
producer.
Engineer. Yeah, the producer that worked with them at Olympic Studios. And he just loved working with Hendrix. He loved the way he was so open to ideas and trying different stuff. And they, at the time, there was kind of a bit of competition with Olympic Studios and Abbey Road.
Yeah.
And he'd been asking George Martin how they got the phasing on some of the songs.
Two tape machines together, one of them where you slightly slow it down by pressing on it, is that
well,
the one?
Yeah. Well, what George Martin said back to him was like, oh, well, you know, chaps, if you look it up in the BBC Radiophonics Handbook, you might just find it there. It took them a few weeks to work it out. And then when Jimmy first heard the results of some phasing he'd put on Bold of Love's drum break, Jimmy was blown away, and he said, my God, that sound, it sounds like something from my dreams. I want that shit on everything.
Well, they did do a lot of that, to be fair.
Well, I mean, that's it, they were massively experimental, weren't they?
Oh, yeah,
they,
yeah,
recordings.
They used to use, like, loads of backwards stuff on it,
backwards
guitars. I mean, Are You Experienced, the title track, the drum track is backwards.
Yeah, everything bar the vocals has been reproduced backwards for Are You Experienced.
Yeah. Have you ever heard Belly's cover of that?
No.
It's really good.
Oh, wow.
There was a Hendrix tribute album in the early 90s that was, like we were just saying earlier about tribute albums being in the boom of the early 90s. It's really weird because it's... you've got some people that are really straight blues on it, and quite boring.
Yeah.
And then you've got people like The Cure on it doing an almost trip-hop version of Purple Haze.
Which is weird.
It's totally unrecognisable.
Did anyone do Castles Made of Sand?
I think they did.
I would love to hear a lo-fi indie version of that.
Well, no, the Spin Doctors didn't do a lo-fi indie version of it. But
what
Ian
a fucking waste of a good song.
We love the Spin Doctors.
No, I don't.
Well, you're the wrong one.
with the recording and stuff, they used to... they'd be playing a gig up in Manchester or something.
Yeah.
They'd then, at the end of the gig, drive back down to London, start recording from, like, 3 a.m. till 9 a.m. Then they'd drive back up north to do two gigs in Liverpool the next day.
Fucking hell.
And they must have been sleeping in the van, I hope.
Yeah.
Although potentially not, because when they played Woodstock, they were the last band. They closed Woodstock.
Yeah.
They actually went on stage at, I think it was 5:30 a.m. on the Monday morning. And Hendrix had been awake since the start of the festival on the Friday.
Fucking hell.
Wow.
Basically, they wanted to wait until after the sun came up, which is why it was in daylight.
Yeah.
And a large amount of the audience had gone home by then, because it was declared a disaster area because there wasn't enough water for everybody. Mm. And, it was just people were getting crushed in the mud.
Mm.
And it wasn't the best organised of gigs.
Well,
and then a lot of them weren't around there. The Isle of Wight.
And there was
Festival.
A bad batch of red licorice.
There was some bad red rope licorice. That was a different festival. That was Wayne stuff.
Oh, I always get them confused.
His last ever UK gig was the Isle of Wight Festival.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good gig. Basically, the sound was terrible. They couldn't hear what they were playing on stage. They were getting really bad feedback problems from the PA and the Audi. So there's a live album of it, and it's just like, I could listen to that, or I could listen to any of the other live recordings that aren't terrible.
Yeah.
My uncle was actually at that. My uncle Steve went to see Hendrix at the Isle of Wight.
Cool.
Which I'd have loved to have seen Hendrix live, but he died 12 years before I was born. A bit difficult.
Tricky.
Yeah. No, he's still alive.
Ah. Which formed the beginnings of the 27 Club.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Janis Joplin wasn't that long after.
Brian Jones.
Brian Jones was before.
Yeah.
And Jim Morrison was before, I think. Might have been after. Never been a big Doors fan, so I'm not entirely sure. Kurt Cobain, quite a long time after.
Quite a while.
Isn't Amy Winehouse 27?
Yeah, I believe she was. Yeah.
She was definitely not before.
No.
But Tim and Jeff weren't. People always say, "Oh, and they were in
the
27
Jeff
Buckley Club."
Was 30,
and as was his, as was Tim.
Yeah, Tim Buckley, that is.
Yeah, his dad.
Yes. There's quite a few conspiracy theories about Hendrix's death.
Yeah,
which there always are when somebody famous dies. There's a conspiracy theory that he was he drowned in red wine is one of the rumours.
Right.
Because there was supposedly quite a lot of red wine in his lungs, but the autopsy report doesn't say anything like that. It says he'd been drinking wine, but it was he choked on vomit that was his own.
I was going to say, you can't really dust for vomit.
You can't, that is true. After taking, he had about 9 sleeping tablets, which were really strong ones, which were given to him by Monica Danneman, who claims to have been his girlfriend.
Right.
She'd only known him for a few days.
Mm.
And she basically gave him these sleeping tablets without telling him how strong they were. That's why he died.
Awesome.
Go.
So she can fuck off. She's dead now as well. But the part of the conspiracy theories is that she had at one point... She's never been straight with her story of what happened. She's changed it over the years. And she did at one point claim that he was killed by the mob.
Right.
And that it was connected to his old manager, who I've completely fucking blanked on his name, who was the Animals manager, he ripped them off. And then because Chas Chandler was sort of stuck in a contract with him, he had to end up being Hendrix's manager. But he died from... He committed suicide by sticking a pipe from his exhaust pipe into his window, which is the exact same way that Monica Daneman died a few years later.
Well, that's weird, isn't it?
That adds to the conspiracy theory, but it's bollocks.
Yeah.
It was... his autopsy report was inconclusive, but it was fairly obvious that he'd just taken too many sleeping pills, really.
Yeah.
But...
So, you know, he did a version of the Star Spangled Banner.
Yes. At Woodstock was his really famous one where he did that.
An interesting story that was done in response to... There was a UK band called The Nice.
Yeah.
Awful name. He toured...
I think it's Nice, then.
He toured with them previously. In July 68, The Nice released a single called America, based on Bernstein's West Side Story tune, and they burned the US flag when they played it at the Royal Albert Hall.
Right.
So about a month later, Jimmy played the Star Spangled Banner at a gig in Georgia, and then it was used as like the theme for the Woodstock film.
Well,
that's such a good response.
Well, when he played it at Woodstock, because there was all the like feedback and like dive bombs with the whammy bar, nobody did that before. It was just used as a little bit of vibrato.
Also, that was sarcasm. It was a shit response.
But I don't necessarily think that's definitely the case, because I've not heard that myself. Might be, but everybody claimed it was a protest against the Vietnam War.
But didn't he? I'm sure I've seen footage of him asking what the national anthem sounds like in other countries.
He played God Save the Queen in the UK. He played that a few times afterwards.
So I'm going to guess that he just did it.
Yeah. I don't think it was particularly a political statement at all.
Like, hey, I'm in America now.
Yeah.
I'm playing an American anthem.
Yeah. He wasn't a massively political dude, I don't think. I think he was into the whole peace and love kind of thing, but I don't think he was ever... I'm against the government, or I'm just pro the government.
I enjoy this because there are drugs and women here. That's pretty cool.
And he definitely had a lot of both.
Yes.
I think the saddest thing about him dying is what he could have come up with next.
Yeah.
He was talking about working with Miles Davis. They were both quite good friends. He was getting into playing more sort of jazz type sound. So, I mean, Miles Davis' Bitches Brew album came out around about that sort of time.
Yeah.
And I think that could have fitted perfectly with Hendrix's guitar playing. Because that Bitches Brew is... it's definitely not your daddy's jazz.
No, it's a bit out there, for sure.
It's fucking great. I love it. Tracy would hate it. I'm sure I would.
they were working on the first rays of the New Rising Sun.
Yes.
When he died. I think it was Eddie Kramer that finished that off, because he could. The only one who could do it, knowing what Jimmy's wishes for it were.
Not quite.
That's what Kramer said.
Yes, that's what Kramer might have said, but that was because he was talking about his version of it.
Right.
He also split it up into three different albums so that they could sell as many copies, sell more records.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah.
Hendrix
wanted it to be a double or a triple album.
Mm-hmm.
Kramer and Mitch Mitchell finished the... Some of my favourite Hendrix music is the stuff that was put out posthumously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my actual favourite version of it is the First Rays of the New Rising Sun, which was the album put together by Hendrix's family in 1997.
Okay.
So Mitchell and Kramer put together Cry of Love, which every single song on that is on First Rays, but they also then put out Rainbow Bridge, which is a compilation.
Yeah.
Well, they're all compilations, these ones are. Rainbow Bridge was the soundtrack to a film, but I don't think much of the music was in the film.
Tim's got a copy of that on vinyl.
I've got that on vinyl. It's got Pally Gap on it, which is fucking brilliant, really beautiful instrumental. But then they put out War Heroes after that as well. So they basically split the music across three different albums and put various different jams and stuff that were unfinished messing about. Then you've got, there was a guy called Alan Douglas got hold of the Hendrix catalogue and he had the rights to it for a while.
Yeah.
And in 1995 he put out an album called Voodoo Soup, which had most of the tracks from First Raising the New Rising Sun.
Yeah.
But he messed about with the arrangements. He got his own session musicians to add bits to them.
Right.
And gave himself writing credits on some of them.
What the fuck?
And quite frankly, can fuck right off.
Mm.
I've not heard it. It might be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in 97, so that was 95, 2 years later, the Hendrix family had got control of the catalogue back.
Yeah.
So they set up a company called Experience Hendrix to sort of reissue all of the earlier stuff. And then they put out First Rays of the New Rising Sun, which, I mean, Voodoo Soup's got, it doesn't have Isabella or Dolly Dagger on it, which are both fucking brilliant.
Okay.
First Rays of the New Rising Sun, if they'd have swapped one of the lesser tracks on that for Pally Gap, it'd be his best album, I think. I mean, I love Are You Experienced, Axis Bowler's Love and Electric Ladyland, but First Rays of the New Rising Sun, for me, it's got most of my favourite Hendrix songs on there. So you've got Easy Rider, you've got Room Full of Mirrors, you've got...
Easy Rider's got such a funky bass line.
There's... And Hey Baby, New Rising Sun, the title track, which was originally... It was put out on Rainbow Bridge the first time round.
Yeah.
It's great. There's a bit at the start where the first thing you hear Hendrix say on it after they've been playing, you know, guitar and just an instrumental intro for a minute and a half or so, and then you see him go, this microphone on, and then start singing, which is, I love that they kept that in.
Do you know, he was actually really self-conscious about his singing.
He hated his singing
they used to have to dim the lights in the studio, and he more or less used to record facing a wall so no one could actually see him doing it.
He used to put boards up to hide himself. And there was one incident where they'd got the light off in the studio and then a load of the hangers-on just came in and, because they thought there was nobody in there, just walked into the studio all talking and turned the lights on and realised he was in the middle of a vocal take.
Because he was massively influenced by Bob Dylan.
Whose voice is way worse. I love Hendrix's voice.
He bought Highway 61 Revisited in 65 and he realised that you could be successful even if you weren't a great singer as long as the songs were good.
Yeah, definitely.
And he took this as, you know, something... And apparently he queued up at the record store in 68 to buy John Wesley Harding. And at that point he listened to All Along the Watchtower and thought, fuck, this is something I could have written, but I never would have got it together.
Yeah.
And that's why he had to cover that song.
Yeah, and then he's obviously the definitive version.
Mm. Well, absolutely. But he hated his own singing.
Which, I think somebody had made a comment at some point which he took to heart.
Right.
Yeah.
His guitar playing is the thing everybody's going to concentrate on, but his voice I really like.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, yeah. He's got a cool voice for sure.
And his arrangements, his songwriting, it's just generally fantastic. Band of Gypsies, the album that he put out after Electric Ladyland, it was a contractual obligation album. Before he came over to the UK, he'd signed various contracts, not really giving a shit. It was like, yeah, alright, I'll sign that, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it sort of came to light that he got obligations, and obviously now he was one of the biggest stars in the world. These record companies all wanted something for it.
Yeah.
So Band of Gypsies was a band he put together with Billy Cox, his old mate from the army, on bass, and Buddy Miles on drums. And it was basically, they played two gigs on, I think it was New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And recorded the set and just put out a live album of the best stuff from them with all new material.
Oh.
And Machine Gun is, I fucking love it. It's going back to when we were talking about him being an experimenter.
Yeah.
His use of technology
was great. I mean, he was one of the first people really using effects pedals.
Yes.
And on that one, he was using machine gun.
Yeah, I meant to ask you that. Was it effects pedals or was it all amp effects then?
No, it was pedals.
Yeah.
There's a guy called Roger Mayer.
Yes.
Who was a basically studio engineer and boffin.
Right.
I believe is the correct term.
yeah, definitely. And boffin.
And Roger Mayer just built various pedals for him, including the Octavia, which is an octave pedal which puts a lower octave and a higher octave above the note, so it fattens up the sound and it gives it... It's not really a harmony because they're octaves.
Yeah.
But it's like you've got three guitars playing at the same time, one lower, one higher. And then he also... There was this pedal called the Univibe, which was supposed to emulate a Leslie rotating speaker.
But it doesn't really sound like that.
It doesn't, but it's...
It does sound awesome.
For his later stuff, it's so iconic sounding. It's almost like a chorus sound.
Yeah.
But it's... So the Leslie speaker is a speaker where... I used to think that it was the speaker rotates...
No, it's just not a speaker horn. Cabinet.
Yeah.
It's not the horn, it's there's a baffle around
the
it.
The top one's a horn.
Yeah, the top one rotates, but the main speaker, there's a baffle with a hole in it that rotates around it.
Yep.
And
the White Stripes had one.
Yeah.
Makes it sound kind of underwatery.
Yes,
we've
exactly.
covered this.
We have.
You're right. That's where we've spoke about it before. But yep. the Univibe was a pedal built to emulate that, didn't quite do the job, but sounds fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
And it is all over the first Raising the New Rising Sun stuff. You know, if you listen to tracks like Hey Baby, New Rising Sun, or Angel, it's Hendrix's.
Angel's a great anthem, isn't it?
Famous clip, yeah, written for his mum.
Oh.
The
drumming on that especially is amazing. What you were saying earlier about his jazz training, I mean. The drumming on that, it's kind of like so loose, but
yeah.
Mitch
Mitchell is my favourite drummer of all time, definitely. I love his,
but yeah, loose but tense at the same time. If that makes sense,
he loves his snare drum. but yeah, Wind Cries Mary, I found out while researching this, was written for Kathy Etchingham, his girlfriend.
Right.
After they'd had an argument about mashed potatoes.
Oh.
Apparently they were too lumpy.
Right, but there's something else about that song, actually. It was about, it's an argument they'd had in the small hours. And there's lyrics at the beginning of that talks about jacks in their boxes and clowns.
Yep.
That's referring to the late night BBC test card.
Oh, yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah,
one of my... feel like I should say one of my Facebook friends is a bloke called Stuart Castledean who makes really, really good Univibe replicas.
Ooh.
Like,
really good.
Right. I may have to get in touch with him as I'm hoping to get one soon.
Do you have a lot of money?
Right, maybe not then.
Yes.
Perhaps I'll go for a Viscous Vibe.
I mean, The Wind Cries Mary, that was just something they did. They'd got some recording time left over at the end of doing Purple Haze and a couple of others.
Yeah.
And they just did it in 20 minutes at the end of a recording session.
And it's one of the fucking most beautiful songs ever written. We've probably better wrap it up there.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
so. So,
what are we doing next episode?
Well, it's the letter I.
For Igloo Tenement Basement Tape.
Is that a real band?
Of course it fucking isn't.
It should be. We need to form it.
Yes.
Igloo Tenement Basement Tape. That's good. I like that. Yeah, that's what we're doing next week.
Also, incel frustration.
Good, they deserve to be frustrated.
Yeah.
Pricks. And castrated. Rather than that, let's discuss...
I Like Trains.
I Like Trains.
I Like Trains.
The band, not the internet meme.
Yes.
And Incubus. I can't wait for Tracy's reaction on that one.
Can we discuss what an actual Incubus is as well?
That's definitely going to come up. We've been We Dig Music. Bye.
Bye. I don't have a black metal name. Oh, no, I do have a black metal name. What with the fact that I'm in a black metal band? Fucking me.
So you do have a black metal name?
I do have, yeah, I'm Revenant.
Revenant.
I picked it because I'm the oldest one in the band.